Good morning.
Hey, what's going on?
Just clearing out my email.
I was looking for, I can't find my Dreamcast adapter.
Dreamcast adapter.
Yeah, because it's VGA and composite video, and oh, I bought a...
Literally a Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah, literally a Sega Dreamcast. And I bought an adapter, an HDMI adapter, but I can't find it. So...
Hold on a second. Slow down. Do you normally play with a Dreamcast a lot?
Okay, let's back up. The year, Bill, is 1999. I still think the Dreamcast is probably the best console ever released. I know games are better and, you know, stronger, faster, sure, whatever. But man, there is something about the Dreamcast as a system. So yes, I still have one. And actually, true story, listener Scott Bowery,
okay,
sent me a Dreamcast and four controllers, because I had sold my Dreamcast before I moved here. I don't regret selling a lot of stuff, but that was one of the things that I really was bummed out about letting go. And he's like, I've got one that I don't use. I'll send it to you. And he was kind enough to send me a Dreamcast.
No, a Dreamcast is a disc-based CD, DVD, CD-based system, right?
Yes.
And what games do you play on it?
Shenmue, Crazy Taxi, Virtua Fighter. I mean, there's a ton of games.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, are they 4K, you know, 60 frames per second?
Yeah, they're pretty crunchy, right? 4:2 at this point.
By comparison, yeah. But I mean, you know, it's all through the eyes that in which you look at them, right? Sure. Like back in the day, Quake was... the thing. I mean, I can't even. I've probably logged more hours playing Quake than any other game.
I still think Super Mario Brothers 1 still looks good.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, Banjo Kazooie, that looks great still. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it depends on how you look at it. If you look at them for what they are, you know, it's kind of like what we were talking about with photography.
Sure.
You know, if you look at your photos through 2006 eyes,
right,
you know, you're like, oh, I can see what I was doing there. But now you look at them through 2023 eyes and you're like, oh, what was I thinking?
Yes.
You know, same kind of thing. When you look at these games, does Crazy Taxi look as good as, you know, Forza? No. Is it fun? You bet.
Yeah.
So.
Are you still being crazy in a taxi? Yeah.
Right. With that soundtrack by like Offspring and, you know,
I had.
Like you couldn't do, well, actually you could do.
Well, get Offspring Grand Theft and all Auto, these people.
Yeah. Grand Theft Auto does fantastic soundtracks. But there aren't a lot of games that can still do the Tony Hawk games always had great soundtracks.
Sure.
But because of licensing now, you know, everybody's got their hand out and rightfully so, but it drives the budget up of these games, sure, exponentially, I would imagine.
I owned I had a 2600 when I was a little kid. I got a NES at some point. The next console I think I actually bought was the original Xbox on launch night in Times Square.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the last console I had. And I only really got it because I was making good money back then and I had a TV and I was like, oh, this would be fun. Let's see what a new console is like. But I've never, for a long time, I haven't been a game person. I feel guilty playing games. Like, I'm just like, wow, I'm really just like taking $100 bills of time and just burning them. Like, that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah.
But and I understand that there's more than that. And I understand that for people who find it, I just know for myself, I would regret it. But there's Baldur's Gate 3 just
looks
came
amazing.
Out.
Amazing.
And it's
amazing.
Available on Mac.
Yeah.
For the first time in like forever.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, $60 maybe. But then I was just like, oh man, if I get into that.
Bill, if Post Malone can find time to play games on tour, mind you. You can find time.
Well, he's got time on the bus or the plane or wherever the hell he does.
I saw like a little clip popped up on one of the feeds and somebody was like, hey, whatever his real name is, Angus
Post.
Austin. Yeah. Post. Are you going to play Starfield?
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, F yeah, I'm going to play the hell out of that. You know, he's like, I got a little rig. I'm going to be on tour, but I got a little rig and I'm still going to play it.
Yeah.
I just
thought
that was kind of funny.
Yeah, it's I mean, no shade to the people who play these things. I just I simultaneously feel like I'm going to regret it a little bit having bought it just because I won't use it enough. And then if I do use it too much, I'll regret that. For
okay, so, let me ask you, yeah. What's the difference if it's the time?
Yeah.
What's the difference between watching, you know, reruns of Gilmore Girls?
Sure. Sure. I haven't rewatched it in a long time, but okay.
But you could.
Sure.
Right.
We're rewatching Psych at the moment.
Okay. There you go. What's the difference of, okay. And the rewatch, that's even the bigger key, right? Because sure. You've already seen it. You already know what happens.
Sure.
So what's the difference between rewatching Psych for the umpteenth time and playing Baldur's Gate for the first time?
I think mostly is just that it's in the evening and I want to do something with my wife. And I don't think she could be another
character.
No. It's not that
she's got a zombie podcast. Of course she can be another character.
It's not that she couldn't do, although you don't want to get her playing games.
Really? Does she just sink into them?
Well, I haven't seen her play a game, but just seeing her play Tetris, she had to remove Tetris from her phone. People on the, there's 15 levels in Tetris, and then there's a level 16, which is 15 that goes on for infinity.
Hmm.
Conrad sits there on level 16 and just like rocks for 45 minutes on her way back from home, from work.
Wow. Wow.
And people look over her shoulder and they're like, oh my God. So giving her something that she could actually sink her teeth into.
Yeah.
Trouble. But no, I mean, listen, there is no difference. And I actually had this conversation with friends of mine who are gamers, where three of them at the table were talking like this. About some new, there's some new game. Is it Starfield? I guess where you have a spaceship and you're going between worlds.
It's Starfield.
Is that the new one?
You can customize and people have already built, you know, Star Wars based.
Sure.
You know, spacecraft.
Yeah.
It's the biggest game in Bethesda's launch history.
Okay. Yes, it's Bethesda rings a bell. So I'm assuming that's the same one. Yeah. Yeah, we were sitting there talking about it, and you're right. There's really no difference, except that I watch a show. We watch Psych for 38 minutes. I don't think I'd play 30 minutes of a game in a night. Right. I think I'd play from 7 till 2 in the morning.
Okay. I wonder if it's
because that's what all my friends talk about. They're like, right. I didn't go to sleep last night.
Okay. Is it different because we are independent, freelance, yada, yada, yada?
No, because two of these people have jobby jobs.
Oh, okay. 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 Yeah. Okay.
I also think that if I'm going to spend that much, if I'm going to spend 5 hours in the night on my own doing something on the computer, I'd rather make something than play something, you know?
But I wonder if that's the, if that, okay.
This you think is I need to play myself. More?
Well, no, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Whether that's playing at making or making it playing, whatever it is, whatever order it goes in. I think part of where I'll speak for me. I don't know if this is true for you. Part of where I get stuck is constantly feeling a responsibility to be productive or to be putting my effort towards something that means something.
Sure.
So I, like you, end up feeling guilty for having sat there and so I don't allow myself. Yes, I have all these games, but I don't allow myself to play them very often. You know, if I come down and play, it's going to take me 14 years to get through Starfield because I only play it for 20 minutes at a time.
Sure.
Right. So, but I know people who go on, you know, I forget what the name, but you go on these raids for like 4 and 5 hours that you're playing these games. And I'm like, I couldn't even imagine that playing for that long.
I can play
for like an hour maybe at a time. Yeah. And then I go, okay, I got to get back.
John Syracuse talks about playing Destiny.
That's the one. That's the one.
And yeah, he's just like, oh, I was on a, and he records all of his raids as video.
Like screencasts of them?
I guess so. And I just think,
that's commitment.
What are you going to do with that? You're never going to watch that.
You're going to go back and look at the highlight reel.
Yeah. Like you're
director's commentary.
Oh, I played that for 5 hours. Now I'm going to go spend 5 hours watching myself playing it. And maybe there are people online who are watching people and saying, oh, look at those people are really good. I'm going to learn something about how they did this or something. Yeah. I understand that there's those walkthroughs. I mean, I understand there's that whole thing.
Welcome to the Twitch business model, right?
Yeah. I mean, but there are people like himself, who also keep all of their old computers in the original boxes up in their attic forever. And it's like, someday you're going to not be around. Right. Then, like, what are you holding on to those for? You know, like, what are those doing for you? And it's...
So I wonder, is it something about just being present and gaming or any sort of activity that takes you out of presence of mind?
Yeah.
Is somehow...
It's like a weird meditation thing?
Yeah, or it's not as valuable, or it doesn't... Because it's not working towards something directly. It might be working towards something indirectly.
Sure.
You know, yeah. That free time... You might be playing something or you know, board games or video games or whatever kind of thing it is, and get, you know, some idea for a shoot, and you go, oh my gosh, sure, you know what, I can do a variation on this, and this would be really cool. And yeah. Then suddenly it becomes worth it. Oh. But the fact that that may only happen once in a blue moon means that the rest of the time it's just sucking time.
I still dream in wizardry from 1985.
Sure. Welcome back. Oh.
Yeah. Proving grounds of the Mad Overlord.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh,
Wardna, and, you know, I had a Mursama blade, and like, I still know all of those things. I can go into most of those maps and walk around and know what's in each room.
Yeah, yeah. See, and that's the way I am with Doom and Quake.
Yeah, and that's 40 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's the fact that our brains hold on to this stuff, especially when we're kids. And I have very fond memories of playing these things as a kid. And you would say... You could say, well, you're an adult. You have time. You don't have kids. Like, if you want to have that feeling again, play again. You know what I mean? Like, that's what Baldur's Gate is like a really fancy version of wizardry, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But I think there's something to the level of import or what it's going to lead to, you know?
Like, yeah. Like, I can almost feel this? My late father yelling at me for spending my time playing games.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though I'm a almost 50 year old man.
So I wonder what that is. Yeah. Because some people can get around it, and they get around it really well, and they still are productive in their work lives, and they're healthy and balanced in their personal lives. Sure. And they're able to manage that.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it is.
I guess, you know what it is? Part of it is that I'm not a big escapist person.
Ah, okay.
I don't like escapism.
Cinema, though, right? Cinema?
Yeah, but I am, you know, while I like the occasional sci-fi thing or whatever it is, like, I don't like dystopian shows. I don't like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't like things that take me out of my own reality.
So there's a parallel to the game world.
I also don't like Halloween. I can't stand Halloween.
Really?
Don't like people dressing up. I don't like things not being what they are. It makes me uncomfortable psychologically.
I wonder what
deep
that's...
thoughts with Bill.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder,
like, I never have.
Really, even as a kid?
No.
So no. You wouldn't dress up as a...
I mean, I dressed up as a kid, but I didn't enjoy it. I didn't plan it out. I haven't.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So do you remember how old you were when you finally said, nope, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore.
10, 12.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think I dressed up in high school, or I think I went to one costume party in college. One costume party as an adult is the only time I've ever gotten.
Do you get physically kind of uneasy about the whole thing?
No,
is it more in your head?
It's in my head. I have this thing sometimes when if I'm in a place I don't want to be, or a situation that just makes me feel like this is not the direction you want to be going in, I get sort of internally antsy, and I'm just like, you know what? Thank you so much. I gotta go. I gotta, you know.
Wow. Does that extend into movies that show, like, you know, the famous like E.T. scene where they're all in costume and everything? Does that make you uncomfortable?
No, that doesn't make me uncomfortable. But there are a lot of movies and TV shows. I don't like Blade Runner, both because it's incredibly boring, but also. I can appreciate.
You take that back.
I can appreciate the world. View, or, you know, the world building.
Yeah,
like, I mean, it's artistically beautiful, but I don't want to swim in that pool. It's sad, and it makes me feel hopeless. It's a thing I've always had.
Wow.
So I think it sort of extends to games, and it, I think nowadays, especially, you know, if you're playing Wizardry, it's literally lines denoting a hallway, right? I mean, it's like, there's nothing to it.
Yeah.
Today's games, you can really get lost in them in a way that they built out.
Yes. To your point, Baldur's Gate is gorgeous. It really is a beautiful, beautiful game.
I've heard nothing but good things about it. So it's part of it is, for me, is that it's like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. There's something about it.
Is something in the Uncanny Valley part of it for you?
I think it's actually that I get sucked into the actual feeling inside of it. I don't know. There's just something about it I've never liked. My wife has a zombie podcast. I don't watch the zombie movies with her.
You don't?
No, God, no.
Like 28 Days Later, that whole thing.
That's one of her favorites. I've seen it, but I don't need to see it again. They're watching, I guess, whatever the new Walking Dead show is, spinoff, which,
I didn't even know there was one.
Yeah, I sent her a, there was a meme yesterday. It was just like, it's 2023. I can't believe I'm still watching The Walking Dead. it's, you know, she does her show in the afternoons or the late mornings on the weekends. And I wake up on Saturday morning. She's next to me in bed with her iPhone watching the episodes. I don't watch that stuff. I don't watch horror movies, really.
So like Last of Us, I mean, that was a terrific show.
I saw the episode with the couple. She watched it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really well done. And I watched the episode with the gay
Ron Swanson.
Yes, that guy. And the other guy.
Why do we only still know him as Ron Swanson?
I don't know. And like, you know, yeah. Here's I'm going to go one step further, and you know, all the psychology majors in the world can figure this out. I don't watch sitcom. I mean, I watch Psych, which is like stupid and silly and referential to itself and whatever. Like, you know, it's silly. Right. I don't like sitcoms. Somebody tried to make me watch Parks and Rec, and I was like, I don't find this funny at all.
Really?
I watched episodes that my sister and her son are super into and rewatching it. And I watched like 5 episodes and I didn't laugh once. I was like, this feels like people trying really hard to be clever and funny. I don't find it funny at all.
Okay. Wait a minute. I got to get comfortable here. Hold on a second. I got to back up in my chair.
I don't watch any comedy shows, really.
So I don't even know where to go with it. None of the, like, Cheers, Seinfeld, Newhart.
Old sitcoms, even MASH, I thought was really well done. Yeah. Taxi, those feel different to me than the new ones. The new ones feel like people trying to be clever.
Hmm.
And it's like a weird Warhol 15-minute thing for me. Right. I don't watch any of those shows. I mean, I've seen them. I've seen probably, you know, 100 episodes of Seinfeld, but I never watched Seinfeld religiously. Yeah. I do not find SNL funny very often.
SNL hasn't been funny for a long time.
I know. Like there's an occasional like music video they do that is like, okay, that's really clever. You know,
But making Coneheads the movie. Bad choice.
Yeah. Like that kind of stuff. It's just like, I don't like silly, you know?
Okay. Man, this is just right. So
should I lay down on the couch right now?
Yeah. Tell me about your muscle. Okay. So like, okay. You don't like silly. So Mel Brooks, not a fan of the Mel Brooks stuff.
In fact, the new version of the History of the World,
was he involved? He was involved. With
yeah.
That,
I watched 2 episodes of that and I was like, this is terrible.
Mm.
People think it's hilarious. I thought it was awful.
I haven't seen it.
What I do find funny is that Kunk on Earth woman.
Oh yeah. From,
Philomena Kunk, the British lady.
Yeah. From, Afterlife. Yeah.
She is, that stuff's hilarious because it's only funny if you actually know all of what she's talking about. You know what I'm saying? Like
because she's playing it straight.
She's playing it straight and making jokes, but the jokes are only funny because you know what they're bouncing off of. If you're like a history nerd, that's funny to me in a way that the Mel Brooks stuff was not funny.
But like the Airplane, none of the
Airplane is funny because that one in particular is funny. But yeah, in general, that stuff, no, but I've seen Airplane a billion times, you know.
Yeah.
Most of what I find funny in Monty Python, you know, are the absurd historical references and stuff. You know what I mean? You know, yeah. Them talking about systems of government and stuff. Like, that's funny because these are really smart people making a joke that could sound serious if you didn't actually dig into what
they're saying. Right, right.
You know what I mean?
But the physical comedy part of
No.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I don't find physical comedy funny at all.
Okay, but that's Pratt a whole falls, other thing.
Spit takes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, the Three Stooges? Never found it funny.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need a minute.
I know. And I have a lot of, I don't even find most stand-up funny. I'll watch an entire stand-up thing on Netflix because people say it's so amazing and I'll laugh twice in an hour.
Yeah.
Be like, this isn't funny.
See, I'm hit and miss with stand-up. Like, I don't find Ricky Gervais typically very funny at all. I think Afterlife is the best thing he's ever done.
Yeah. I think he's a good example to me of somebody who's very smart. And when he's doing sort of smart, funny stuff where he's actually playing it straight.
Mm.
I actually really like that more than I like him trying to be funny. I was talking to...
what about Carlin?
George Carlin, I find very funny.
Yeah.
Mitch Hedberg, I found very funny.
I like Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah, Mitch Hedberg's funny. That kind of stuff where it's like, okay, you found a really interesting angle on something that's very obvious.
But silly and goofy, not your thing. That's never, interesting.
Never has been, never as a kid.
Says the guy who did 400 Cheeto videos.
Yeah. Yeah. Cheese balls. But yes, only 100 of them.
Sorry. Cheese balls.
Yeah. I mean, and some of those were funny. I guess a few of those were funny. But yeah, I mean, they were.
You would never write a comedy.
I'm writing a.
Or would you?
I'm writing a relationship, like romance thing. And there's sort of. There's rom-com-y like banter in it.
Right.
I find that
different
stuff,
though, than a comedy.
I like rom-coms. You know, I'll watch When Harry Met Sally and there's funny things in there, but I'm not laughing at them. I'm just like, oh, that's good. You know? So yeah. Yeah.
Well done you.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, for some reason, I just can't.
Wow.
Yeah.
The honest to God, Bill, this is blowing my mind.
Well, it's there may be something wrong with me, but yeah, no.
No. Well, not for that. No. Not for that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you and I make jokes and we laugh at them.
Yeah, but maybe they're not funny.
Definitely aren't. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm sorry if this is blowing your mind.
No, it's interesting. Okay, so Adrian and I have been watching this show called The Diplomat.
Wait, is that the one with Kerry Russell?
Kerry Russell and the great Rufus Sewell, who I love.
I do like Rufus Sewell and I like Kerry Russell. Watched like 2/3 of the first episode while we were on a trip. And I was just like, I'm not into this right now. And I turned it off. Should I keep going?
We love it. Yeah. It's got just enough of that Sorkin kind of banter. Yeah.
The problem I had with it was the episode in the beginning when, I don't know, there's something in the first episode where she says to her husband, like, don't you understand? I can't go over somebody's head and talk to this. And he's just like, yeah, you know, your husband was also a diplomat for his entire career. Yes, he knows that already.
Yeah.
Like it felt really like they were trying to tell the audience, but they were telling somebody in the show that's just, you know.
No, it works.
Okay.
It works. It's a really good show.
I'll try it again. I like Rufus Sewell.
Just don't watch the funny parts.
I saw Rufus Sewell on Broadway years ago.
Did you really? I adore him.
I'm trying to figure out what the hell he was in that
terrific
I watched.
Actor. Man in the High Castle, for those of you who maybe don't recognize him, he was in that as well.
Yeah.
And then Kerry Russell was in The Americans. She was fantastic in that with her now husband, Jonathan Rice.
Oh, God. I think both of them are very good in that. I think he's even better in that show.
Yeah, he's great. He has a boat. Did you know this? He's got a boat called the Rarebit. It's like this boat from the 1930s, like a cabin cruiser. Yeah.
Okay.
And they tore it down to the bare wood and restored it. And now he does cruises around New York City Harbor, like around the island.
Wait, I could actually go see?
You can. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
And he's on the boat, like telling stories and, you know, serving, you know, champagne or whatever it is.
Wow. I should do this. I went and saw a play called Rock and Roll on Broadway in 2007. Tom
and
Stoppard
Rufus Sewell was in it.
Rufus Sewell was the main guy, and Brian Cox.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big theater guy.
Yeah, it's so interesting. If you go see theater or you go see stuff, and then years and years and years go by, and then you are reminded of something, you're like, wow, I'm really glad I went to see that while it was playing or whatever, you know? Can I switch directions just a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, we're fine. We can
Wait,
keep.
Is it funny? I'm kidding.
Well, the reason I bring this up is that there's a Manet Degas show that just opened at the Met.
Mm. And there's a Degas show that's opening in the fall at the National Gallery. That's all of his works on paper.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it's a Manet Degas show opened on Sunday, but they had 3 days of member previews. So Conrad and I went on Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which you think wouldn't be that busy. And we were in a line of 150 people to get into the preview.
Yeah, I bet.
And it was packed. And it was...
Do you think more people were there for Manet or Degas?
Manet. Because,
really?
Well, because Olympia is there.
Wait. My mistake. I misspoke. It's not a Degas show. It's a Rothko show.
Oh,
my mistake.
Rothko drawing show?
Yeah. Okay. Works on paper. My mistake. My mistake.
It is Manet's show, and Olympia, which is like one of his big famous paintings at Musée d'Orsay, is here. It's the first time it's ever left Europe. And so it's here for like 3 months.
Wait, I thought Olympia was at the Louvre.
No, Olympia is at Musée d'Orsay. And another...
Winged Victory.
Winged Victory is there. Yeah.
That's at the Louvre. Yeah, okay.
And so there are, I don't know, around every corner... is a painting that you look at and you think, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like that's here. You know,
how many pieces total do you think?
It was 12 rooms.
Oh my God.
It was huge.
Wow.
And you know, it's funny because my wife and my mother and I are heading to Paris in 2 weeks and
to see Olympia.
Almost all of the stuff I wanted to see at Musée d'Orsay is currently at the Met.
Nice.
I mean, it was, The Degas absinthe, the girl sitting drinking absinthe, that's there. Wow. Everything is there. And so we watched a documentary on Manet. There's a guy named Wildemar Janswick or whatever it is. Do you know this guy? He's a British, he's like a BBC art host guy. And I'm gonna text you his name because I can never remember how to pronounce this. Can you pronounce that name?
Wildemar Janisak?
Yeah. Okay. So maybe? He did a show that's on.
Come on, we're historically terrible with names.
Oh yeah. Except for Robert Doisneau.
Robert Doisneau.
So he did a show, like a 2 hour or an hour and a half movie on Manet and the birth of Impressionism, where he like goes through, and he's one of these, you know, presenters who's like really fun, like kind of like making jokes along the way and like walking out of frame. And then, you know what I mean? Like these kinds of, like he does those kinds of art documentaries.
That you find funny.
Well, I find them fun. I don't find them funny. Anyway, he ends up going to all these places. Every single thing he showed in this thing, except for one painting, was at the Met right now.
Wow.
Like all of it's just there.
Wow.
So if you are anywhere near New York City in the next 3 months, you have to go see this show. It's amazing. I'm going to go see it like 3 or 4 more times while it's there.
Wait, okay. So maybe we can do an in-person thing when you, when are you going? When are you traveling?
Next 10th week? To the 17th.
10th to the 17th.
So two weeks from today.
Is it still there when you come back?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when you come back, let's coordinate.
Okay. You want to come up? We'll go.
And we'll go through it.
We'll clip mics on and just do it.
Yeah. It'd be great.
Yeah.
Do they allow you to do that?
We'll clip it on in a way that no one notices. All I'm saying is that, you know, there are these things that happen. And I tried to explain this. Heather's little sister came over the other night we watched Jaws for Conrad's birthday. And Sophie was here, and I was like, Soph, you have to go see the show, because she's an art history major. I was like, someday you're going to talk about the fact that you were in New York in 2023 when the Manet show came through here. You know what right. I mean? There's like these ones that there's these things in our history that happened. I was thinking the other day, we went to see a show at the Whitney. And I was like, you know, I like the old Whitney building better on the Upper East Side. And I was like, the best thing I ever saw there was that William Eggleston show where it was seven rooms of dye transfer.
Yeah.
Prints on the wall. And it's like, this will never happen again, you know, but I was there and it was fun. You know what I mean? Like those are the sort of the things that I love collecting, you know, like these experiences like that.
Speaking of the Whitney, there is a poster in this show, The Diplomat, for the Jasper Johns show that was at the Whitney.
Ah, see?
And it's as you go into Kerry Russell's office, it's just near the door. It's this big poster showing the Johns at the Whitney.
Yeah. And it's funny. You like some of these things come and go from these museums. And a lot of them are, you know, they're very important to certain people. They're very important to the artists. They're very important to history. But some are like, okay, it's like when we went over to Amsterdam to see all those Vermeers. It's like,
right.
They will not get 28 Vermeers together probably in the rest of my life. You know what I mean? Like, that's it. That's the one.
I mean, they did have the show at the National Gallery in the 80s or
and they had 23 of them or something like that. But like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, but it was in the 90s, actually, because my sister went. But that's 25 years ago. I might not live another 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, like this is the level of stuff we're talking. So anyway, this Manet Degas show, you gotta go. It's amazing.
Let's see, man. Degas.
And you know what else it kind of made me think? I was walking around looking at these paintings.
And it's just called Manet Degas. That's cool.
Yeah.
Did they do a book for it, by the way?
They did do a book for it. I got the book. I haven't opened the book because I'm considering keeping the book sealed.
You're a knucklehead. Open the book and look at it. What are you going to sell it? You're going to, give me $100. I'll give you this book.
Yeah. How destitute am I? I'm like,
I got a pack of smokes and a Manet Degas book. Take your pick. What do you want? $100 for each. What do you want? $150 for both. What do you want?
It's true.
Yeah, this looks nice. I'm looking at the book right now. $65.
Is that what they're charging for the book?
Yeah.
Anyway. So there's these things. So I'm walking around and I'm looking at all the things. And there are some paintings that are, I'm going to use photography terms for clarity on the thing. There are some that are wider shots, right? That are sort of environmental of people in spaces.
Right.
And then there are some that these people have done that are sort of like tight portraits, like, you know, sort of more of a headshot kind of painting of these people. And it is so interesting to me, the stuff that I was drawn to or the stuff my wife was drawn to were not always the same things, you know, but I was always drawn to the ones that had more stuff going on around the people, you know, that were wider angle or further back as it were, you know. And it just kind of, it sort of supports my recent theory that for like my personal work, it doesn't make any sense for me to shoot any tight shots because I don't find them satisfying. I don't like, the results end up being like, okay, yeah, but I'm not excited about that in the way that I am when I show more stuff around it. It's like, I should just, you know, I have my long lens for if I have to do work and somebody needs a long, I've got to go shoot some cover thing today. And I'll use a long lens on that because they want like a flat perspective. But
now, when you say you want to see more, do you want to see like the Annie Leibovitz shots that show like the light stands and the backdrops and all that? Or do you just want to see more environment?
The thing about more environment generally, I like the ones that Annie does where she does that. The thing that I don't like about that is that she's building sets so that they look good like that, which then the set is really just further out. You know what I mean?
Right,
like
the
set extends into the lighting, which is fine, but I'm talking more in spaces that I don't control, you know, more environmental stuff rather than backdrop stuff with that. But yeah, that kind of thing. And
interior, exterior, do you have an idea?
Both, but I kind of like interiors. So it's, yeah, like I just think about Las Meninas. I think about the sergeants I like. I think about all these a bunch of these mayonnaise that I'm looking at, and I just think, yeah, those are the compositions that I'd want to make. You know, when you get inspired by seeing other people's stuff, it's like, you know, in the same way that, you know, you go look at Rauschenberg and you're like, oh, I want to make stuff that feels like that. And I don't know what that sensation is, you know, that sort of, ooh, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a combination of, I mean, for me, it's certainly inspiration, but it's also knowing that it's just out of my reach. That I can work through similar steps and processes and even materials, but I'm not going to get that.
Sure. But is it the end result you want to get, or is it the process that you want to ride? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think by and large, it's probably the end result, because I don't know enough about how he worked through things or felt about the process. I follow a guy that on Instagram that was his.
I was going to say, there's not a lot of stuff about him in his process.
Not that I have seen. Maybe okay. There is, but I haven't seen. I would love to see a big, you know, comprehensive documentary about him. But there's a guy that I follow on Instagram who was his partner for years and years, worked alongside him, printing, building substrates, building the frames, built, you know, like was, I don't know what you'd call it. It wasn't his studio manager, but anyway, he collaborated with him and built some of the behind the scenes stuff for decades. And in this one post on Instagram, he said he had a bunch of, you know, ideas of what to do with Rauschenberg's work, what Bob wanted done with his work, kind of thing. It was the way he said it. Yeah. And the foundation, the Rauschenberg Foundation, took over and fired him. So now he's not, you know, involved.
Like you're giving away the secrets?
Yeah, I guess.
Isn't it weird? You know, there's a show on BBC called Fake or Fortune. Did you ever watch that?
No.
Oh, Jeffrey, you...
What's it called? Fake or Fortune?
Fake or Fortune.
BBC.
Imagine a...
Fake or...
Hour-long per episode, you know, hour-long episodes where an art dealer, a journalist, and a bunch of scientists try to figure out if the person of the week's art is real or not.
Oh, wow.
And they go all back through the provenance. They go through they go through history, and they're
like, yeah, this looks cool.
Oh, here's a picture of that painting up on the wall in this thing. And it's the same one because on the back, you can see that there's red letters that are what this guy used to write on his thing, the stuff that he owned, or, you know what I mean? Those.
Wow.
Then they go back to Christie's and they're like, oh, here's a catalog from 1863. And yes, it was sold on February 4th in lot 26. It's super fascinating and fun. They you know, over dramatize a little bit, but not too much. And
wait, can we watch BBC One here? No.
Well, you can find, there are a few episodes of this on Amazon, a few episodes on Peacock, but you can find a lot of them on YouTube.
don't tell anybody.
I mean, just between you and me and the thousands of people who are listening. Yeah.
Yeah, so, this looks really interesting.
Oh, it's in fact, here, I'm going to just put a link to Fake or Fortune full series 5. It's 3.5 hours long. It's a bunch of episodes. They just chunked together.
Yeah, great. Great.
I'll
How
put
long has it been on?
I think there's 11 seasons.
Oh, wow.
4 or 5 episodes per season. It's been on for a while.
Look at that. Wow.
Anyway, it's super fun. But one of the things that they do is often, depending on the artists and how old they are or whatever it is, there's always someone who gets to make the final decision. And often it's like a foundation, you know, it's the Degas Foundation or whatever.
Right.
Decides
we
whether or not.
That, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That crap. And sometimes they do, they accept it, but oftentimes they don't accept it. And it really feels like it's not because they really don't think it's real. It's just that it would make them look bad if they added one.
Oh, really?
You know what I mean? Like there's politics involved in it.
We thought we had everything.
Yes. And if we say that we missed one, or we say that there might be more out there, then everyone's going to come out of the woodwork with them and blah, 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 blah. So we're just going to sort of flatly deny. And a lot of times they'll send this stuff in, they'll send the artwork into these places, and what they get back is a letter, yeah, you know, from the foundation.
But okay, so this is funny because I went and had lunch with Michelle, our friend at the National Gallery,
sure,
and we were talking about this. I said, I asked her, has all the good stuff been found? She's like, oh God, no. No, yeah. there's still a ton of stuff out there that we don't know about.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be, of course, you know, authenticated and all that. But, you know, it's not like, you know, all the good places have been explored. There's still a ton of stuff out there that we don't know about.
Yeah, there was a Gainsborough painting, you know, which is like a 18th century British landscape artist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this guy had this painting. His family had had for a couple generations. Somebody in the early 20th century, they said it was real. It was like listed in their stuff. In the 70s, they had it appraised, and they said it was actually by this guy who made fakes of his in the 1800s or whatever.
Mm.
And so these faker fortune guys go all the way back and find provenance all the way back to like the 1870s, like that it was owned by fancy rich people which totally match all the things it's supposed to match. The back of the thing has stamps on it from all these different places that are the actual places that it was over the years.
Right.
They do a test, and it's just like, there's no materials in here that are after the 18th century. They look and they do x-rays on it, and they realize that it's actually painted over another painting, but that painting's from like the 1720s. And they're like, well, there isn't a lot of examples of Gainsborough like reusing other people's things. So that's a bad thing for it. But then
so it must be a fake.
Yeah. But then at the next thing, they realized that this was the year that Gainsborough had no money and was asking his landlady if he could like, you know, stay without paying for a while. And there was another one found from that same time period that was also overpainted to an old painting.
Wow.
And then this expert comes in at the end and says, I've looked at it and, you know, the brushstrokes look too hesitant. So I think it's a fake. And you're like,
after all of that.
Yes.
After all of this forensic evidence, he goes, it doesn't feel right to me.
Yes. And this is the stuff that drives me crazy, is that like that one in particular. Yeah. You watch it. It's funny, your reaction.
You're
to
like,
that.
What?
That's the reaction that Conrad and I had. We're sitting there going, wait, hold on a second. So this stuff does, it's like, it feels sometimes like that guy's the world expert on Gainsborough. He can't say that something is real because, you know what? 20 years ago, he said a very similar one was real. That's, and what if it. He was wrong on the other one?
If he's wrong on this one, now everything he's done comes into question.
Right. So then you tend towards, unless it's absolutely, absolutely locked down and I can't possibly be wrong, I'm going to say it's wrong.
But I mean, God, just what you've described, all of the forensic evidence seems to be pretty solid.
Yes. Yeah.
But then he goes,
yeah.
Nah.
Yeah. They were all like, I think he might say yes, whatever. And then the guy walks in, he's like, yeah, no.
Nah,
and the guy's like, womp, 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 womp. And it turns out that the painting underneath, the underpainting, you know,
it dogs at cards?
No. It was a portrait of some woman by some famous artist. And that was actually worth more than the fake painting would have been.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, so they said that the underpainting was real, but the overpainting was not?
Yes.
Wow.
So like, you'd get into this, and anybody who's listening to us going, this, hey, this sounds actually
show.
Interesting.
This is this.
Yeah, this was episode one of the one that's on Peacock right now.
Okay.
So this is the kind of stuff they do. And it's interesting. But like, you bringing up that guy talking about the Rauschenberg Foundation or whatever it is, it's like, dude, the dude's dead.
Yeah.
Are you worried that people are going to understand his techniques and make more fakes? Is that what you're worried about? Because that's not what you should be worried about. What you should be worried about is like letting his knowledge and understanding feed into more people making art with his techniques.
Let those experiments in materials and technique be explored.
Yes.
And let them push the medium forward.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Because it's not about art at that point. It's about commerce.
Yeah. It's about gatekeeping.
Right. Exactly. And you know, I understand that, you know, it's a little bit like that whole Avedon thing where the printer made the set of prints and Avedon never signed them. So the Avedon Foundation says they're no good.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. You know, what does it really change Avedon's entire career that there's another set
does his,
of
does
the
his
Americans
legacy fall apart?
American West? Exactly. And everyone knows where they came from because it's the guy who printed them that has them.
Yeah.
And he's not going to do anything with them. Maybe his kids are going to sell them when he's dead. So like this kind of stuff is the stuff that drives me bonkers.
Yeah, all of the gatekeeping around art is really fascinating to me.
And
I know very little about it, admittedly, but it's the more I learn about it and the more conversations like this that we have or conversations that, you know, down at the gallery that I overhear or am part of, you just go, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Like, what is your goal to educate and inspire? or to gatekeep and make money. Like, sure, pick one.
Yeah, to control all of this stuff.
You can't seem to do both.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's tricky. And, you know, the other thing I kept thinking about was, you know, when I say that half of Musée d'Orsay was at the Met right now, I mean, it's hyperbole, but not, you know, like
a lot of pieces, but the Musée d'Orsay has a ton.
Of course, of course. But a lot of good stuff is here. Like a lot of, oh my God, I know that painting, even if you're not a giant art nerd, are there right now.
So wait, do they borrow then to fill the space, or are they just empty walls?
This is what I keep thinking, is that the great majority of this was stuff from Musée d'Orsay. Like, I mean, not great majority, but maybe almost half of the stuff in the whole show was from Musée d'Orsay.
Out of their collection or on display?
On display, because most of it's real famous stuff.
Yeah.
So, and a few things were from the Met, a few things were from a billion other places around the, you know, there were a few from National Gallery, a few from whatever, you know, places around the world. But this show, from what I understand, was at Musée d'Orsay and now is at the Met, and that's it. And it's going to go, everything just goes back. It's like, we're going to do one in Europe, one in North America, and then it's done.
And then it's done. Yeah.
But all I could think was, wait, hold on a second. What did the Met have to promise Musée d'Orsay to get all of this stuff here?
Right.
Olympia has left Paris two times before this, once to go to Venice 10 years ago, and once to go to somewhere in Russia, which they now say that they regret, like 6 years ago. But those are the only two times it's ever left Paris.
Wait, they regret sending it?
Yeah, I guess it was a, let's bring Russia into the European world and try to make connections. And then obviously, you know, Putin deciding to start wars and stuff makes it look bad.
Wow.
But it's not going to come back to the US anytime soon. You know what I mean? It probably won't leave Musée d'Orsay anytime soon, but like, What does Musée d'Orsay get from allowing all this stuff to go to the Met? Did the Met promise them half the stuff in their European stuff for some show next year? Like, is there a backroom conversation?
Or even in 25 or something?
Yeah. Like, all right, we're going to get all the Cezanne card players together. So you're going to lend this in 2029. And you know what I mean? Like, is there backdoor dealing going on? There probably is. Some sort of letter of commitment or something. You know what I mean? Like,
Or maybe
it's just like a bunch of people having drinks at some place and they're like, all right, I'll trade you five mayonnaise for, you know.
Right. Tell you what, throw in the shipping.
Yeah.
You got a deal.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not paying for crating.
Exactly.
You pay for the crating, you will do it.
Could you imagine what the insurance is like on $100 million paintings?
No. At multiple $100 million.
And do you send them on boats or planes? Which is safer? Plane goes down. Do you send them on multiple planes?
I would imagine you don't send one load of you know, and some of the world's great.
We're on an Air France thing. Is it going on a plane like that, or is it going on a special plane that, you know?
I would imagine it's like private cargo. I mean,
I don't know.
What an interest.
I would be fascinated.
Like one company that's their job.
In fact, I met a guy skateboarding down at the skate park down here. It's like, I don't know, 50-year-old guy. And he was an art major, moved to New York in the like early 80s, somehow got a job working at Christie's or one of those. And that's what he does, is he like crates up and controls art there. But I'd imagine though, Jeffrey, that all the questions we just asked about, like, wait, how do they do it? How do they move this? I bet you all of them would say that's operational security. We do not talk about how we do it. But like, oh man, a documentary on how they move a show around?
Yeah.
I would be all in on that.
Same.
In fact, if anybody knows of one that exists, I'll do some Google searching after this, but I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Can we go into camera corner for a minute? Camera corner. Here I am in the camera corner.
Hold on. Here's the motor drive. That would have been better without the mic bump at the beginning. There it is.
All right.
Bill on film.
Bill on film.
Oh, it's a new segment.
That's pretty funny. So last week after last week's show.
Last time on Taking Pictures.
Yeah. I uh, uh, I threw around the idea of buying a Leica M10. Ugh.
I mean, sorry, did that come out? Was that my outside voice? Sorry. Go ahead.
Wait, why do you say that? I just want to know.
Well, because it's another camera for you to find a problem with.
Yeah. 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 Okay.
Like, I don't like the sound. There's too much dampening. There's too little dampening. There's too much.
Okay.
It's too sharp.
Okay. I do believe there was one camera that I haven't liked that I've ever owned.
I know, but I'm never going
to
let it go.
And, well, we're going to get to that in a minute.
All right.
So.
M10. That's a digital, right? So it's not film.
It's a digital M.
That's the monochrome.
24. No, not monochrome. 24 megapixel. Basically, like my M4, except digital.
Yeah.
I liked the idea of like, okay, here's a camera that is. I think it has aperture priority. You could put it in auto mode, but like, you know, you could just shoot it basically like a film camera that doesn't have film. That's basically what I imagine. Mm-hmm. I have some friends who have these things. They're Leica people. They talk about how small and how wonderful built and, you know, all this kind of crap.
Yeah.
I mean, I've owned a Leica for 20 years. So like I understand they're very nice. Yeah. But there are people who are really into that stuff. Right. So.
And look, no disrespect. They are beautifully made cameras.
Yeah. And.
But it's kind of like going to Harvard.
Yes. Right? It does feel like going to Harvard. Although I do like we were talking after the show last week, Nikon put out that new, what is it called?
ZF.
ZF. Yeah,
it's like a digital FE2, FM2 kind
yes.
of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is like, imagine if I wanted to go in that direction, but I'm not a Nikon guy, right? You know what I mean? Like, okay, I've got a couple lenses for Leica already. I could buy an M10 and now I can shoot basically manual, but don't have to pay for film.
Yes.
Okay. So my friend Matt said, hey, a guy I know is selling one.
An M10.
Yep. $4,000.
It's a better option than selling your Fuji to spend $4,000 to get the other Fuji.
Okay. So I went and I looked at it the other day. Nice guy, Joshua.
Do you like the viewfinder?
I mean, it's a rangefinder, so it's great, you know, if what you want is a rangefinder, you know. And so we stood in the vestibule of his building. He has a new baby. So we were in the vestibule of his building and I'm like, it was raining. So I'm just like clicking around the vestibule, taking pictures.
I love that this is the kind of shady dealing for Bill is standing in a vestibule with a guy and his baby checking out a Leica.
It was like, I know. It's like, are you buying drugs? Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. So I
see, that's funny.
Yeah. Me buying drugs. It's hilarious. So I'm there and I'm playing with it and whatever it is. And, you know, and the guy's like, well, you know, I could do this and I got a Godox remote. If you want that, I could throw that in for $100, you know, whatever, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Okay. If you're going to charge me $100, that's not throwing it in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then eventually he's just like, listen, I'll do 4,200 for the body with the remote with a 35, millimeter Voigtlander lens. Cause I don't have a 35.
Oh, that's a good lens.
Yeah.
What's the F on it?
I don't know.
F2
maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's fine. For my purposes, it's fine.
Yeah, it's great.
And I came home. I left not being excited about it. You know, I didn't buy it. I was just like, let me think about it. I'll let you know either way. And I walked away not being excited about it. And he's texting me. He's like, oh, here's the pictures you took while you were playing with it. You know, if that makes you, you know. And in the end, I was like, you know what? If I'm not excited about getting it, I'm not going to be excited when I get it. You know what I mean? It's $4,000. This is not like, okay, I mean, if it was $1,000, yeah. But
you've thought about selling your current Fuji and spending 35 to get the next Fuji.
Yes.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that is one that I would actually use for work. I would never use this Leica for work. I know myself.
This is a play camera.
This is a play camera. This isn't I need a camera to do stuff with. This is a camera that I just, you know, I want for fun. That I would, it would be a travel camera. It would be I'm going to grab a camera because we're going out with friends for brunch. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Walk around camera.
Here's the thing. Let me throw something in here.
Yep.
You have been the last several episodes. We've talked about some of the fun, some of the excitement, some of the enthusiasm around photography waffling a little. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say that's true. if you've got the money and a $4,000 investment can potentially light that up again, even if it doesn't, you can sell that and not be out a whole bunch of money, because Leicas tend to hold their value.
If anything, I'd probably sell it for what I got it for. Yeah.
Yeah. So taking a chance on something that may reignite. I mean, there's a bigger picture, and the bigger picture, because we're talking about photography. That's funny. is do you want to be fired up about photography again, or are you done?
Okay. Well, so I started a new,
and maybe that's a bigger conversation.
Well, I started a new Instagram account the other day.
Yeah. Is this the one you're posting older square photos? Come on.
Well, I'm posting newer and older square photos.
Don't post the older ones. Post the new ones. Don't go back. You can't go back.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that I've never posted because I never post stuff like this on just my regular account.
All right. I'm just saying, you say you're going to do new stuff and then you post old stuff.
Well, yeah, but this is just walking around stuff. So these are walking around pictures. They're square. I guess you would call these, I don't know, like street photography kind of, but not of people, just sort of, you know, things. Yeah. This is the kind of work that I do that I'm like, okay, yeah, I could take a picture of that. Yeah, it looks pretty cool.
Okay. Let me jump in here for a sec. Do you still have your 500 CM?
Yes.
Why not get one of the digital backs for that and then do digital square?
Because they're not square. None of those backs are square.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
The digital back that goes on the square format camera
isn't
is not
square.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
If somebody made a 50 or 60 megapixel square full frame back that went on the Hasselblad, that's what I would use as my camera.
That's a good choice. Can you imagine the boardroom meeting for that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So when you want to shoot portrait, you actually rotate
the camera that you look down into. So now you look at it from the, good choice.
Yeah.
Excellent
choice. Okay. No, I'm with you, but like, yeah, that's true.
Really?
Yeah. As far as I know, there hasn't been a square. There was a 16 megapixel square back, but the square was smaller, made for the Rolly 6006 back in the day. But I think it had
decision.
To be tethered to use it.
Okay. Well, then I redraw.
But
whatever I'm doing.
Making a new little thing, because I don't want these like with my portraits. These are just like fun things. So I just made a new account.
Yeah, yeah.
Putting these up is sort of I'm probably going to end up, what I'm going to do in Paris, my plan was to bring the Fuji with just the one little pancakey, the smallest setup. Have it set up to shoot square only with the back screen. So I'm using it like a Hasselblad.
Sure.
Looking down at it.
Yeah. Effectively just looking at an action kind of viewfinder.
Yeah. And I still end up with a 70 megapixel image that I take home and like basically limit myself by shooting the whole thing that way. And that will be my trip photography situation.
Good. Do it.
Yeah. Good. Well, that was the plan. So I go look at this M10. And I decide, and then so I emailed the guy yesterday. I was like, yeah. And all these other people keep saying, oh, it made me look at the world a different way and all this kind of stuff. And I say, maybe it does. Maybe it would. But I've never found that gear really inspired me that much. You know, I like having a bigger file and all that kind of stuff. But I've never bought a camera that changed the way I saw photography, you know.
Yeah,
because
for
me, it's really not about photography. Photography is the means to the end. It's not, it's the people, it's the final image. It's not the photography. You know what I mean? So putting that aside, so I meet a guy the other day, for reasons that I'll get into some other time. I don't want to say his name.
Okay. Was this another vestibule kind of thing?
Yes, actually it was.
Fair enough.
Because I sold him a CFast card that I had. Is that the little thing?
I don't know.
They're like a little SSDs. It's the compact flash replacement that are
right.
1.7 gigs per second. You know, basically a little SSD in a card.
I've never used one, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I have no need for one, but I acquired one up at the workshop last year.
Yeah.
Where Lexar rep was like, yeah, just put it in your pocket. You know, like, because I was giving it back and he's like, eh. But
Were you wearing a coat when you did the exchange and you opened it up? Like instead of having watches hanging there,
no. But I did get in the guy's car. Does that count?
Did you know this person? Dude, well, seriously, you don't get in a weirdo's car.
So I said, what did you want this for? And he said,
I've got this op coming up.
Yeah, pretty much. He said, I got the new GFX.
Oh, the one that you want, the 100S2.
Right.
It uses that.
Yeah. As one of the slots. Which is actually one minor ding to it, in my opinion, for my purposes, because those things are made for video. And a lot of the new features in the new camera are video features, which I'm probably never going to use. So, you know, nice to have, I guess, but I'm not using it as a video camera. Anyway, so he says, anytime you want to come see it, come see it. So yesterday I went and saw it.
The GFX 2.
Yeah. The GFX 100, the second, as they call it.
Yeah. Do they really call it the second?
Yes, that's what they're asking me to call it. It's the GFX 100, the second, officially.
Did Kanye West make this? Is that the deal?
Is it a shoe made caps? Out of rubber with lots of holes in it? So I went and tried it, and the EVF is the best I've ever seen. It's 9 million pixels. It's removable. So if you want to shoot down and don't want the thing in the way, you can click it off the viewfinder. You can also get an adapter to make the viewfinder be able to tilt up. So you can look down into the thing if you really want to.
Yeah. I will say it's a beautifully designed camera. I've never looked at one. I've never held one, but just the industrial design of it, that slightly slanted top plate.
Yep.
Gorgeous.
It focuses way better. The responsiveness is a lot better. Mm-hmm. The shutter is far more satisfying sounding. It basically...
Did they fix the trigger issues for flash sync?
I don't know because I didn't use it with a flash. Mm. Actually, I did play with it with a flash for a hot minute. But I wasn't shooting. I did some test shots of him with a flash or without the flash. And I took the files back and I played with them last night. And the files look exactly like the other files. So file wise, it isn't any better, but it also doesn't seem like it does the one thing that drives me crazy in the 100S, which is that when you turn it on, it feels like it's doing stuff all the time. Like it's going.
It
just feels like there's like motors and
is
gears.
It a focus hunt thing? Like it's always,
I think
it's always
partly
hunting?
The sensor stabilization stuff.
Oh, cause it's got the sensor shift.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
sure,
I think
sure,
it's
sure.
like, it's always up on, magnets.
Yeah.
Even
interesting.
Even if you're not using stabilization, the whole thing is levitated.
Yeah.
So I think it's always trying to do stuff. Yeah. And there's autofocus stuff. And it feels like there's aperture stuff. Like it's always doing stuff, you know, it's like, calm down, you know, camera, just sit there until I tell you to do something. Anyway, played with it. It was really nice. Like it felt like far more like an R5, like a really high end Canon that does what you tell it to do when you tell it to do it, except it has a much bigger, it felt more like a Canon R5 than it did a Fuji camera.
Right. Well, maybe rent one this time, take it for a spin or borrow this guy's.
Yeah. So I come home and I said to my wife, I was like, oh yeah, I went and played with the new Fuji today. She's like, how was that? I was like, yeah, pretty good.
She
whatever.
Tosses you the checkbook.
Yeah, she's right, just like, she's like, just get it. And I was like, I'm not going to get it. I got to sell this one. She's like, just get it. I haven't gotten it, but it
you
was
could just get it.
I mean, right now I can't cause they're all back ordered, but, and the price of the 100S is crazy down. People are selling them for like $3,500. I paid 58.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so, you know, this, you're going to lose money on it.
Yeah. Luckily, most of my money's in the lenses and the lenses are all still.
Yeah, they're great. All, you're going to keep those. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the moral of the story is that if I hadn't bought that camera last year and I ended up buying this camera this year, I probably would be more happy with it than I have been with my Fuji so far. You know what I mean?
Okay. Then there's your answer.
Well,
just figure out a way to get it.
Well,
it's
exactly.
Your tool, right?
But it is interesting though, that like this one, not that I'm not dying to get it. What I have is fine. Both this one and the Pentax. But it is interesting that one of these I played with and I went, oh yeah, I could totally see myself using this. And the Leica, I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm ever going to use it. Like I'll regret that one. I don't think I'd regret the other
good
one.
Choice.
Anyway, just update on that. But the fact that I got a little hands-on on it was interesting because
yeah, nice.
I don't think most people have them yet. I think it's this week that they're starting to go out, and this guy got his hands on one. So pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff.
Love it.
Quick photographer of the week.
Get it. I don't have one. Do you have one?
I have one.
What do you got?
Do you know Arno Raphael Minkinen? I don't think we've ever done this guy.
Arno?
I'm sending you a link.
Got it. Arno Raphael Minkinen. I got it on here.
He does self-portraits of like weird wide angle things of like body parts of himself. Like go click through some of the ones from the 70s.
Oh yeah. Huh.
And he's been doing it for decades.
And they're all self-portraits.
I think so. Maybe not. There's a bunch of other people. But I think that they're black and white and they're kind of minimalist, but they're also not absurdist, but they're definitely, you know, doing things with bodies in places you wouldn't imagine.
Okay. I love the one of
give me a decade.
It's the 70s. Okay. Kusamo Finland of his leg coming off the front of the boat.
So yes.
What a great shot.
Yeah. Like that kind of thing.
That's a terrific picture.
Yeah. They're like really, really neat. Right.
Yeah.
And the
next
one with just the fingers.
Oh yeah. That's good too. Oh, see, those could be, that's really great.
So there are things like this that I just think that something different, you know what I mean? This guy, I somehow bumped into him.
But like him, really him?
No. I bumped into his work. I also like how he's got, if you go to the 2020s, it says, 2020 through 2029. It's like, well, a little presumptive there.
Yeah. in the 2020s, the shot of him around the tree trunk with the arms and legs around the tree trunk. That's terrific.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. This is a good choice. Fun.
Yeah. See,
fun.
And definitely looking at stuff in a very different way than I would ever think to look at stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And also not for nothing, but you know, we're getting older and here's a guy who's perfectly fine being nude in his self-portraits in probably his 60s or 70s. You know what I mean? Like he's an older dude.
They're still, I mean, look, none of the ones that I'm looking at right now, I would label not safe for work.
No. It's not kind of nude.
It's not gratuitous.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's like weird artsy things. There's one, if you go into the 2010s and you click through, there's one where it's like his head on top of a stump in the water. That's actually really cool too.
I wonder, from a technical perspective, do we know anything about, does he have an assistant? Is it just him? Is he setting up these shots?
I do not know.
How is he framing everything?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he like, you know, sets it up, focuses, puts on a trigger,
the head on
timer.
The stump is terrific. Look at that.
Yeah, cool, right?
That's a really fun shot.
And he did a few where in the beginning of the 90s, there's one that is like his bare feet in snow next to water, but it almost looks like it's clouds in the sky. Foster's Pond it is.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
And the one after really it where cool. It's like him upside down on top of the boat.
Yep.
Like it's just really interesting ways of looking at the world.
What a terrific vision this guy's got.
Yeah. Here's philosophy and practice. 50 years of chronology of my self-portraits has always been based on desire to write. Photographs speak because the world is still. Unlike film, nothing moves in a photograph. The world is flat. Unlike sculpture, a photograph is only as thick as the paper it's printed on. The world is luminous. Unlike words, without light, a photograph is breathless to say anything. The world is eternal. Unlike hearsay, a photograph always lives in the present, provided nothing is manipulated. And the world is magical. Unlike the known world, a photograph can reveal a new reality we've never seen. This is right up your alley.
Yeah, this is, I mean, if he's still around and talking.
He's bowling a bowling ball right up Jeffrey's alley.
After obtaining a BA degree in English Lit from Wagner College, Minkinen spent 5 years as a Madison Avenue copywriter working primarily on automobile, airline, and camera accounts. A headline he wrote for Minolta Cameras, "What happens inside your mind can happen inside the camera."
It's a good line.
A camera, sorry. Inspired him to study with Harry Callahan, holy Christ, and Aaron Siskin at RISD, where he received his MFA in photography in 1974. Wow. Yeah, there's some stories there.
Yeah.
Crazy.
You got to look this guy up.
Yeah, seriously.
74, that means he's probably, what, in his mid-60s, something there? Maybe.
If not later.
But he's got a contact thing.
Let's see.
Give him a buzz. Minkinen, I guess it would be, right?
Minkinen, yeah, it looks like it.
Arno Raphael Minkinen.
Born 1978. Born 1945.
Then I would definitely contact him while you can.
Yeah.
See if wow. It works. Anyway.
Yeah. How fun.
Somebody different.
Yeah. Good selection. Good choice.
If anybody wants to get a hold of us, podcast@ontakingpictures.com. We'll send us an email. If you guys have questions or anything, send them on. We'll add them to the end of a show. If you want to leave us a voicemail, 929-390-1916. That's 929-390-1916. We love getting those. And we love it when you guys review things on iTunes and whatnot, because it gets people to notice things, because, you know,
yeah,
the algorithm.
Hey, the speaking of iTunes and all that, the iOS 17 podcast app has been updated. I don't know what all, I just read the headline. I didn't read any further, but I know a lot of people have been complaining about that app for a long time. I've never had a problem with it. So I'm curious.
That's what you use?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. I used to use Pocket Cast a lot, but it's just, the integration is so much easier. It's the Apple ecosystem.
And yeah.
The Overcast?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been an Overcast guy for a long time.
A lot of people use that. It's a good app.
I don't know that I use any of the features that I couldn't get in the podcast, the regular podcast app.
Same. That's one of the big reasons I stay with it, is it's sort of like the stock mail app. It does what I need. It's fine.
You actually use the stock mail app? Interesting.
Used to use Spark.
Yeah.
But
I always go back to Gmail on the web.
Because
everything's in Gmail. So it's like, you know, if it's on the web, I'm used to that. That means I can get to it anywhere.
Yeah, sure.
I don't have to think about it. Yeah. Got anything else?
No, good one. Good one today. Thank you for being here, everyone. Well, almost everyone.
Are you thanking me for being here? Because
I'm thanking you too.
I'm the only one here, Jeffrey.
Well, by the time, you know, by extension, I'm thanking you.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for being here, everyone. Yeah. We'll talk to you next week.
We'll see you there.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something. This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I